Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and this hour...
Well, the honeymoon's over.
Galapagos.
This is the place where Darwin began to develop his theory of evolution.
And it's the place 170 years, or maybe 180 years later, where our producer, Tim Howard, landed wearing fishnets and a Bad Brains t-shirt to find a very different landscape than what Darwin saw.
Now, we just told you a story about how far humans are willing to go to protect something.
This next part... it's about how far we're willing to go to get something back that we've already lost, to sort of restore a place and a creature to its, quote, wild state. This story unfolds on one of Galapagos's most northern islands, where they also had to get rid of some goats. It's called Pinta.
Yeah, Pinta was a very special place.
This is James Gibbs,
professor of conservation biology at the State University of New York. It's one of those islands. It's not part of any tourist visitation site.
So there are no people there.
And when you set foot first on Pinta, you immediately sense sheer abundance. All the insect life. All the birds.
Problem is, on Pinta, things were spinning out of control. The vegetation was growing wild. The forest was getting overgrown with the wrong kind of plants. And the whole ecosystem was just teetering out of balance. And one of the reasons for this, according to Linda Coyote, is that
we had an island with no tortoises.
Because tortoises are sort of like the lawnmowers.
You know, they plow down vegetation, disperse seeds.
But for centuries, they'd been hunted by those whalers. And in about 1906, the Pinta tortoise went extinct. 1906? Yeah, a little over 100 years ago. They don't know the exact date. But then, one evening in March of 1972.
Yes?
This fellow.
Peter C.H. Pritchard.
He's a well-known tortoise researcher. He was on Santa Cruz Island having dinner with some friends.
And we got into chatting about tortoises.
And one of the people he's eating with says, hey, I was recently on Pinta Island collecting snails, and I saw this...
tortoise. And I thought... do you know what you have done? There have been no tortoises there for 100 years.
He and some national park rangers race out to Pinta, and there it was.
This beautiful tortoise.
One male tortoise, maybe 50 years old, they weren't sure. They'd eventually name him...
George.
Lonesome George. But at the time, the immediate question was...
are there any more?
Because if they could find a female for George, then they could... you know, maybe de-extinct the species.
So I poked around in the areas where we got the one, and I found a shell of a female.
Hey.
Dead animal.
Oh.
It wasn't... How had
this female tortoise died?
Someone chopped it in half.
No.
You could see the marks where it was just chopped up. I felt violent. I wanted to borrow someone's gun and go and kill the person.
Everyone held out hopes for just finding more tortoises back.
James says they kept going back, combing the island.
With highly trained tortoise-sniffing dogs.
But in the end, there was just George.
And that then shifted the focus on, now what do we do?
We then went to a wolf volcano.
Island next door.
And collected two females.
Two females that sort of looked like George, but weren't quite the same species.
And we put them with George to see if we could get him to breed. He never did.
Wasn't interested. So they thought, maybe he needs a Pinta lady.
So
now, of course, there are no female tortoises on Pinta, but they thought, you know, maybe a zoo somewhere or a private collection has one, because you really never know. So they called around, offered huge cash rewards. People sent in dozens of tortoises, but Linda took one look at them and was like,
no, 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 no.
They weren't Pintas. So then they thought, we've got to take matters into our own hands.
Basically, what you do is you sit at the back of the tortoise, and first you have to get to where they'll allow you to touch them. And eventually you start you know, fondling their their legs and tails and right. and hoping to get them to ejaculate. And had a volunteer working with me. Her name was Sveva Grigioni. She worked with him every other day or so for a few months and was never successful.
We were really starting to get kind of desperate about options.
And James says, in a way, it was a paradox because on the one hand, awesome, we have an actual living Pinta Island tortoise. But on the other hand, he might have actually been, like, the worst possible candidate for last of his kind.
He seemed to really like to keep to himself.
He never really liked other tortoises much. He didn't seem to like humans.
And maybe that's why he survived. He wasn't curious. James says a lot of tortoises.
They hear your footsteps, they raise their heads, they come out to see what's going on.
And then they get whacked.
Yeah.
In any case, for about 40 years, scientists tried everything humanly possible to get Lonesome George to mate with another tortoise so they could resurrect the species and bring Pinta Island back to its original state. Nothing worked. Until one day in July of 2008, George turns to the two female tortoises that he had been ignoring for years, and he says,
"Hello, beautiful. And beautiful."
Inexplicably, he just suddenly decides to mate with both of them. They each lay eggs.
Two clutches were ultimately laid in his corral.
And the scientists are like,
"George got our hopes up dramatically, but they ultimately were infertile."
Mother.
In the mid-80s, they were having a meeting about this.
That's conservationist Josh Dunlin again.
A whole bunch of herpetologists were out there and some island conservationists, and they're talking about what to do with Pinta, and they can't get Lonesome George to reproduce, which they're hoping to do, because then they could build a Pinta population and put it on Pinta.
And he says that as the meeting wore on, it got tense.
Oh, for sure.
In fact, one guy I spoke with,
Harry Green, I'm a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Cornell University,
said that at this meeting, there was one guy who just couldn't take it.
All I remember is him just fuming. He sat there getting more and more and more frustrated, and finally he just blurted out, "Shoot that f-ing tortoise and quit wasting our time."
Because in his view, this single individual was holding up this huge conservation opportunity.
And of course the shock was, there was a wave went around the room when he said that. I recall seeing sort of a second wave as the Spanish translation passed around the room.
And really what that guy was specifically saying was, don't be precious.
A tortoise is a tortoise is a tortoise. Let's just take some tortoises
from a nearby island
and put them back on Pinta.
But there's a much bigger question here.
That goes way beyond Galapagos.
Which is basically like, what is the right way to protect nature now?
People are right now throwing beers at each other around what is the right strategy.
Josh says that there are basically two camps right now. On the one side, you've got this classic, like what you might call Eden approach.
Conservation biology, its foundation is this idea of pristine wilderness.
From the very beginning, I think all of us, well, I can't speak for other people, but you always have this idea of wanting to get it back to some kind of pre-human condition.
Pre-human being the operative word. And if you think about it, we all have this. We all have this picture of what we want to bring it all back to. You know, it might be like,
oh, give me a home,
the plains just covered with
buffalo.
Or maybe the Serengeti Desert with lions and elephants, or maybe it's 10,000 hammerhead sharks, but whatever the scene is, that just doesn't have any people.
But is carrying that idea, those pictures in your head, even like useful anymore? It's like
so cynical.
No, but it just seems so unrealistic,
right? But I mean, in the bigger picture, you can make the argument that humans now affect every square meter of the earth.
There's no place, no matter how remote we get, you can go to the North Pole, it's been affected by human activity. You can go, I don't know, the depths of the impenetrable jungle, it's been affected by human activity.
That's Holly Doremus. She's an environmental law professor at the Berkeley School of Law in California.
We're radically remaking the world. And the question is, what's our responsibility?
And this brings us to our second school of thought, which in its most extreme version goes something like this.
We're God, we might as well get good at it. And we're going to have to create these ecosystems based on our best science.
And you could argue we're going to have to get a whole lot better at making some very, very difficult decisions.
Climate change seems to mean that a lot of species are pretty much doomed. 30%, 40%, 50% of the species now on the planet in a few decades may be disappearing. Yeah. And this is what I think is really the tough question now, is if we concede that we can't any longer save all the species, then does that put us in the situation of having to decide which ones we'll save and which ones we won't, and do we have any basis for making those kinds of decisions?
Hmm.
So you're saying that the quote, let's go back to when it was good, let's go back to a better time, that's just silly.
I didn't say it was silly.
Okay, what did you...
Yeah. I said it was impossible. Things might not be silly. They might not be stupid ideas, but we still might not be able to do them.
Okay, so here's a wood plaque that says, Lonesome George is the last survivor of the dynasty of land tortoises from Pinta Island. And in fact, in 2012, after decades of trying to get him to breed... Lonesome George dies. R.I.P. 24th of June, 2012. And the Pinta tortoise went extinct.
So damn, case in point, I guess. No going back.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought. But then I spoke with this woman.
Hello.
Hello, Gisela, do you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Who kind of scrambled everything up for me. Can I get you to introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Gisela Caccone. I am a senior research scientist at Yale University.
And Gisela's come up with kind of a radical idea.
I call it the Phoenix Project.
Here's the backstory. In the mid-90s...
We started in 94.
Gisela and some folks from the Galapagos National Park, they began taking a census of all the tortoises in the Galapagos.
Every population of tortoises on all the islands.
They were going to do this big population study, so they went island by island, took a little bit of blood from all these different tortoises, did a genetic analysis...
And opla...
found something they never expected. A group of tortoises, not on Pinta, that had a lot of Pinta DNA.
I remember very clearly that moment was very, very exciting. It's like, yes, look at this.
Yeah. And
wait, you're saying this Pinta DNA was on another island?
Yeah.
Not on Pinta?
No.
How would that happen?
We don't think it was natural.
Gisela thinks it might have been the whalers.
Either the whalers or the pirates.
You know, because like we talked about in the 17, 1800s, these whalers would come along, grab a bunch of tortoises, put them on the ship, and then they would hunt for whales.
Or she blows!
And sometimes...
When they were done and the ship was filled with whale products...
There's no room down here!
They'd throw a few extra tortoises overboard. Say, a few from
Pinta.
Maybe those Pinta tortoises swam with the currents to that nearby island, set up a little expat community, and started breeding with the locals.
That's our working hypothesis.
Which brings us to her idea.
You know, on average, 50% of your genome comes from your mom and 50% from your dad, but it's an average.
So Gisela thought, just by chance, some of these tortoises are going to have a little bit more Pinta DNA from their Pinta ancestors than others.
Yes.
So what if we took those tortoises and bred them together?
Select them for the next generation so you can give a push to this process.
She says if we keep doing that, taking the babies with the most Pinta DNA, breeding them together, slowly, surely.
In four generations, you could have 90% of the Pinta genome restored.
Really?
Yeah, but that's four generations of tortoises, not rats, which means at least 100 years.
But in the meantime, the vegetation on Pinta is growing out of control.
From an ecological point of view, Pinta can't wait.
So in 2009, they come up with a stopgap. They take 39 tortoises raised in captivity and they use them as placeholders. They sterilize them and put them on Pinta.
Really?
What?
And they, yeah.
Wow, these are very purist sort of visions they've
so
got.
They, yeah, they sterilize 39 of them.
So they're just basically the lawnmowers. They're not actually
exactly,
producing.
And they put them on Pinta, and they're just chomping away right now. They're living out their lives really happily on Pinta, you know, until the originals are ready. Now, Linda says, in the end, you don't actually need to do the full aggressive four-generation breeding thing.
You can just take the best Pinta-ish tortoises you find and put those on Pinta.
And, you know, over the next 200,000 years, they will evolve into a Pinta tortoise. And it could be a bit different than the past Pinta tortoise because evolution and mutation and all that doesn't occur the same. But eventually, nature's going to take over and they will evolve into Pinta tortoises.
Is this the way that everybody who works on the tortoises thinks about it? This kind of deep time?
I don't know. I'm not sure many other people think about that.
Just walked past a newspaper that says 72 hours left in the electoral campaign. Flags are still flying everywhere.
We'll be back in less than 200,000 years.
Yeah, but we will be different when we come back.
Yeah, we will.
Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Emily calling from rainy Vancouver, Washington. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.